entering Representative David Bly, and he's got a subcommittee under Carlos Mariani's committee, and he emailed me this week to wonder what could he do about running his meetings, because legislators, and I was one of them, kept coming later and later, and then at the end, somehow the legislators left, and he didn't have anybody there to listen at the end, and he didn't have anybody there to listen at the beginning. So I told him, you know, you just have to start on time, and then people will come earlier next time, hopefully. So I'm going to try to model that and start on time ourselves. And I want to welcome everybody who's here to help us in the chairs on the outside, and certainly want to welcome the senators and representatives who are here with gold stars for being here on time. And I just want to say that Representative Terry Morrill is not able to be here, or he undoubtedly would have been on time. He was able to be here last time, but when we changed the date, then this time he isn't able to be here. So he wanted to have me express his regrets, and I will do that. And I welcome two more representatives that have come in, and I'll have people introduce themselves in a minute. But I want to specifically acknowledge and point out Representative Bud Heidgerken, who is not on the task force, but he is the lead Republican on the House Education Finance Committee, and he's going to serve as an ex officio member, just like in conference committees. At times we've had a sixth member who participates fully, just doesn't have a vote, but can be influential, as we know Representative Heidgerken is. And then, of course, we're publicizing this to all the members of the legislature, because this is definitely a very important committee, I'm thinking, and everybody that's interested is always welcome, including Senator Rummel and Representative Norton. If you want to be at the table like Representative Erickson is, feel free to sit up here as well. Senator Bonoff and I are going to co-chair the task force. And before I go through just the charge and then we go through the agenda, I think I would like to go around and have the members of the committee introduce themselves. And if Senator Bonoff, if you want to say anything about your hope for the committee or the other members as well.
Well, thank you very much. I am Senator Terry Bonoff, and I serve on the Education Finance Committee as the Vice Chair, so I am honored to be here. This is very important work that we're about to do. We know that the people have been saying for some time that we need funding reform with our school funding formula. It is our hope that by sitting around this table and working in a bipartisan way with the House and with the Senate, that we can make something happen. And I should also say that Commissioner Segrin will be joining us, and that she was not able to come here today, but she too will be chairing one of our meetings. So with that, and I'm glad to see that Senator Scogin is here. I don't know what the status is of our other two senators, so I'm disappointed that as of yet they're not here.
Senator Scogin,
thank you. Senator Dan Scogin, District 10 up in the Fergus Falls voting area. Senator Stump asked if I'd serve with this task force. Do it gladly, and also serve on the E-12 Education Budget Committee.
Good afternoon, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jim Dabney from part of South Minneapolis, as well as having spent 16 years teaching in the Buffalo School District, and serve on both the K-12 Finance Committee and the, are we calling it the, no, we're not calling it the E-12, the Education Policy.
Oh, Policy.
Policy Committee in the House. And glad to be here.
I don't think it's
good. Thank you.
And I'm Representative Carol McFarland, representing White Bear Lake, former school board member from White Bear, so I bring that perspective. I serve on the K-12 Finance and the Higher Ed Workforce Development Finance.
And Representative
Bud Heidgerken, and again, I always tell everybody I come from Lake Wobegon, where the children are all above average. Right. But anyways, I'm the lead in K-12 education. I sit on both education committees and a couple subcommittee groups as well over the past year. So my interest and passion as a former teacher and as a former school board member, is with education.
You have to be careful what you say on this committee, Representative Heidgerken, because after your comment, Representative Dabney doesn't miss much, and he just said, I guess you don't need as much money in your district. You can see how this is going to go.
With above average cost?
Yeah. I spent part of the morning with the old MCA study. So
we noticed how Minneapolis, we thought you'd be wanting to highlight that study. Okay, if we could have the other members who are, I'm delighted that you are all here, just introduce yourselves as well, please.
My name is Pat. I'm from Farmington. Representative Packer Offlow represents Southern Lakeville, Farmington, and portions of rural Dakota and Goodhue counties.
Representative Chandra Erickson representing East Central Minnesota, that's Princeton, Malacca, Onemia, Isle, Pierce, and Foley. I am the Republican lead on policy and also serve on the Finance Committee. We'd like to see some equity in rural Minnesota.
Representative Kim Norton from Rochester, Minnesota. I don't serve on any K-12, although committees, though I do serve on higher education, but served 8 years on our local school board and have been involved in education issues for many, many years.
Representative Tim Faust from Kennebec and Pines, a little bit of Santa County,
and also was the author of the legislation in the House that created this. So thank you for that.
Senator Sandy Rummel, I'm on the the K-12
Finance
Education Policy Committees. I represent the Moundsview School District, White Bear Lake and Centennial School District.
Thank you all very much for the introductions. I am just very, very pleased that we have this task force and that we are not starting from scratch. Obviously, we have a very big task before us, but we did have that Taxpayers Association study that Representative Dabney recommended to us here, because it showed that Minneapolis was, 70 or 75% underfunded compared to other districts in the state, and St. Paul was 29% underfunded, so I'm sure we'll hear about that report. Then the governor had his task force, and then we've had the three education groups, MREA and AMSD and C, that picked up the ball and continued on with the work, and they hired the consulting firm that led by John Myers, and then we have now the PS Minnesota report, Public Schools Minnesota. And so we are going to start out with looking at that report, and then we have some items on the agenda that the Senate requested be put on, and one of them is the consolidated levy that the Senate put forward last year, and they would like to explain it more to all of us so we understand it just as well as they do. The location equity index they requested so they could ask questions of the House members. Quite frankly, it's just exactly like what's in the PS Minnesota report, so unless senators have questions, then we probably won't spend a lot of time on that, but we can because it's a request of the Senate. And then also a request of the Senate is to add to the agenda the operating capital revenue report that Tom Melcher is here from the Department of Education to go through that, and that would more be property tax relief, which I know we're all for that as well. And it's definitely, you know, there's a tug and pull of how much state funding versus how much property taxes has to go into education. So we appreciate those suggestions for additions to the agenda. And then hopefully we'll end by 5 o'clock. But I think we want to spend a very good amount of time going through the PS Minnesota report, because that will be the basis in my mind of where we start, and I'm guessing that a lot of what we will have in our report will reflect that by the time we get around to January 15th, should we be so lucky as to finish at the date of our charge. We have, just to review, before I turn this over to Greg Vandell, the charges of our task force are to make sure that the funding formula remains adequate over time. And for me, I'm very glad that that's the number one topic, because I think that no matter how we change the formula, we definitely have to face what when we do figure out in a formula we can agree on, what is it going to cost to fund that formula? And then we're looking at simplifying. There's ideas in PS Minnesota. The consolidated levy is another one of those simplifications. We are looking at the categorical funding, and that's part of PS Minnesota. They've done some research-based work on that. And then we have to figure out how to implement what we recommend. And there are some other states that have done it in a multi-year plan. It's obviously, next year is not a funding year, so I think we're probably looking at the following year for serious implementation beginnings. But then what kind of schedule can we be on, and how do we have to do it? If you can't do it all at once, which is would be the fair way to do it, then how do you do it as you're implementing it so it's fair in transit? And then finally, looking at regional delivery structures like the school, intermediate school districts, the educational cooperative service units, and so forth, is there anything we can think of that would make us more efficient in what we're doing, or economies of scale, or anything like that? It would be, I think, kind of icing on the cake to be able to include any of those things. The final thing that I will say before I have Dr. Vandell come up is I'm thinking of this task force as similar to what we did last year with special education. We put a lot of money into special education, but instead of just pouring it in with business as usual, we did two other things. And one of them was, how can we have less kids going into special ed in the first place? We have the response to intervention that is heading off earlier intervention than waiting till they're 2 years behind. Representative Faust authored that one, too, along with Senator Salzman. And so that was doing something different. Business, not as usual, just more and more money, but how to do something differently. And then coming from the House and the Senate kindly adopted that as well, was the looking at what we're doing and is there anything we can do differently there. So we have this task force that's going through all the statutes and rules that exceed the federal standards. And then we're going to have a report from them for next year to see if there's anything that Minnesota has required that we could not have to do, or that we could do in a lesser measure and save money. If not, at least we've examined it and we know that everything we're doing is something we want to be doing and we can justify. So hopefully we're not just looking at pouring more money into the current funding formula. We want to examine it, make sure everything that we're doing is needed and fair. But then I think it will, like special ed, require much better funding as well. So with that, I think the PS Minnesota has addressed almost all of these things. I'm not sure about number five with the regional delivery charge that we have, but maybe they can come up with something later for that. But Dr. Greg Vandell, if you could come forward, and Dr. Vandell has shared this. Hopefully you have thought of it as a thankful task, so that we will have a thankful task up here. I'm sure that it's been thankless at times as well, and you've provided a lot of leadership. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Representative Garland, Senator Von Hoff. It is my pleasure to be able to address you. Very excited to be able to...
I'm sorry. Excuse me just 1 minute. Chaz Anderson is here. There you are. Somehow I didn't recognize you down there. Why don't you come up to the table, because you're a full partner, and I should mention that we're rotating the committee chairmanship of this committee. I'm chairing this meeting, Senator Bonoff is chairing the next one, and then Commissioner Segrin will be chairing the third one. Her mother is not in good health, so as Senator Bonoff said, she's not able to be here because her mother is in town, and I told her, definitely spend that time with your mother. Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Anderson instead, and she did. So, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I do have to leave briefly at 4 for about 15 minutes, but I'll be right back. So.
Very good. Thanks. Okay. Dr. Vandell.
Thank you once again for having given us the opportunity to speak with you today. Many of you have heard some of what I'm going to say, and I'm going to suggest to you that this is intended to be conversational over the course of time. But I have a bit of the preacher in me, and I can wind myself up and make it sound like it's a sermon, and that's not what it's intended to be today. So I'm going to invite you from the start
to ask any questions, to make any comments all along the way that you might wish to make. I'm here representing a coalition of education organizations from across the country, a coalition that has come together over the course of time in an effort to try to come up with a funding system that we believe is rationally linked to what it is you want us to do, rationally linked to the state standards. I have in front of me a couple of different presentations, so if you don't want to hear the task force presentation, I could offer you my letting presentation. I've been doing that all across the district for the past several months. I also have a Did You Know video with the planning section that we've got. If you haven't seen a little Did You Know, the Shift Happens video, it's a wonderful little piece, so if you want to stay after for that. But I suspect what you're here for is the task force report, and what I'd like to do is to begin with that. While this is booting up, I'd like to spend a moment not talking as the PS Minnesota spokesperson, but really step back into my real role as the superintendent of schools. Because I had promised Shannon I was going to try to get this PowerPoint to her so that she could make copies and have them available. But my phone kept ringing and my email kept beeping at me. And this was my morning, because the first email I had today was from, I'll say, an irate citizen who wanted to carry on a virtual conversation with me about our operating referendum. And his beef with me today was that he wanted to know down to the, quote, last penny, how we would spend our proposed operating referendum. And we were requesting $700 a pupil unit, and I tried to explain to him that down to the, quote, last penny was rather difficult in any budget, but generally here's what we were going to do. I took an email from a school board member. She notes that I'm going to speak to a senior citizen group on Thursday at one of the nursing homes. And her mother-in-law is there, and her mother-in-law called her and said, you know, the directors of this nursing home aren't really in favor of this. And they've suggested to their patrons that your levy referendum request will raise their monthly payment by $120. Monthly. And so my response to her was that that must mean that your mother-in-law lives in a $1.3 million apartment, because that's the only way it would have that kind of a tax impact. Had an email from a person who suggested to us that he wanted all of the administrators in our school district and all of the support staff, because he'd heard that we're not only overpaid, but we spend far too much money on administration. So I spent time explaining that we actually spend considerably less than the state average on administration. And I had an anonymous letter offering to give back some of my salary to help offset the cost of the levy referendum. And these are all just this morning. As I'm pulling away from the school, packing up, thinking about what today is, I'm driving by the signs. We have one family that's very concerned that this levy not pass, and so we've made a lot of hand-painted, very vibrant signs, like Noah's Victory and signs like that. But one of the signs at the end of the school driveway, right at the private property, is, there is a better way. And I thought to myself, I might not agree with this gentleman on lots of things, but I have to agree on that. I shouldn't have had to spend my morning talking about an operating referendum, because frankly, my role as an educational leader was not truly fulfilled today, or yesterday, or likely tomorrow, or any time in this two-month span, because I'm spending an inordinate amount of my time talking about an operating referendum. And by the way, we're a non-levy district, Sauk Rapids, right? By some of the analyses, we're rated 333 out of 339 in terms of state and local support. So this is not a place where we have lots of resources to give, and so we've been asking for a $700 levy referendum. The better way is some of what I'm about to talk to you about today. And then, this did not get it. I could be in trouble. Then the other notion I would leave with you is that in the wee hours of the morning, one sometimes begins to think about the kinds of things that are really going on in life. And the wee hours of the morning for me today were about 3:30, and for whatever reason, I flashed back to when I was a senior in high school. And as a senior in high school, I was a theater person and was in the one-act play. And the one-act play was Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. I don't know if you have read The Lottery over the course of time, but to me, it was like my subconscious at work, because it feels a touch like what I'm engaged in right now. Because in The Lottery, you may remember that once a year, the townspeople line up and they pull tabs out of the basket. And there's one black dot in the basket. And you find out in a horrifying moment at the end of the lottery that the person who draws the black dot is the person who's stoned to death. And it's a ritual that has happened. It's a classic short story written in the 40s. Operating referenda feel a bit like that to school districts all across the state, because we know on the evening of November 6th, some of us are going to win that lottery and some of us are going to lose. The losers are going to be the children in those school systems. this genuinely is a better way to fund our schools, and that's what we're about today. We're trying to present to you a vision for how to tie education funding to student success, how to rationally link what it is you expect us to do to the amount of money that you provide for us so that we can accomplish those goals. I'm going to walk my way through a presentation. As I suggested to you, you can feel free to interrupt me any place along the way. Where have we been in recent years? Representative Dreiling mentioned some of these just a short time ago. I've been around as an educator in Minnesota long enough to remember the Minnesota Miracle. I had nothing to do with bringing it into being. I was a teacher and a principal under much of the Minnesota Miracle, but I think most observers would suggest that the Minnesota Miracle has since unraveled. But it is considered to be a hallmark, not just in the state, but across the nation as an appropriate way to fund schools. We considered whether or not to market what we're talking about as the Minnesota Miracle Revisited or some such thing like that. Recognize that it might have partisan ties. Even though we recognize that if you take a look historically at the Minnesota Miracle, it was a bipartisan effort to try to fundamentally change the way schools were funded so that all of the children of Minnesota would benefit. We would suggest that that's what we would wish to have happen again. All of the children of Minnesota to benefit. The Governor's Task Force took this subject on about 5 years ago and, as a matter of fact, produced, we think, a substantive report. What it did not do, however, is it did not quantify the cost associated with delivering what it considered to be an adequate education. And so consequently, a couple of groups, Schools for Equity Education, Minnesota Rural Education Association, and the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, this was truly PS Minnesota, decided we were going to hire John Myers to take a look at the governor's work and to quantify what he had done. That's where that first $1 billion number that you referenced came about. And we got a lot of press, not all of it necessarily positive, as education groups were standing up, and imagine that, asking for more money. We, in fact, tried to focus our energies on what the governor had started, tried to complete it. And we found, according to the Myers work, that using the governor's documentation, using the governor's research methodology, we could find, depending upon the way you slice and dice the numbers, $1 billion more that could have been invested. We're not here today to try to dispute, to try to argue on behalf of, we're not trying to say that our data is superior to anybody else's data. We are here to invite the continued discourse. One way or the other, we have begun some of this effort. When we brought the $1 billion number forward, the challenge was, well, this is, you know, flawed methodologies and suspect numbers and educator math and all of that kind of stuff. And so what we decided was that more study needed to be done. The three organizations I just mentioned, we're joined by several other coalition partners, and we grew to 17 different education organizations, and decided that we would engage in extended study. We commissioned a study through the Augenblick, Kulach & Associates firm out of Colorado, nationally respected school finance experts. They also examined the cost of delivering adequacy in accordance with the existing state standards, and they brought back similar kinds of results. What they suggested to us is that today's students were expected to meet today's standards. These were quantified, by the way, in 2004 dollars, then additional $1 billion would be required to be invested. If today's students would be meeting tomorrow's standards, according to the APA report, $2 billion, or about $1.7 billion more of investment would be required on an annual basis. We had the cost behind us. We were then challenged by policymakers to talk about how best that money might be spent. So consequently, what we did is we turned our attention to the development of a funding framework, and that's really what we're here today to talk about. Knowing that an investment is required, knowing that additional resources would be needed to drive the system, how best might those resources be expended? And that's what I'm here to talk about today. If you go through the characteristics of a good school funding system, we have a handout that has some detail on this, and you might want to reference this in your after hours, but essentially this presentation follows this format, the funding framework. A good school funding system is based on standards. It's based on standards. We know what it is we expect our kids to learn. We have some sense of what it takes to get them to that level, and so what we need to do is we need to tie the system of funding to the standards that are in place. We recognize that a good school funding system is adjusted for differences in district property wealth. I heard the word equalization just a few moments ago. That's essentially that argument. That if we're going to move forward with a good school funding system,
It shouldn't matter where a student lives, whether it's a high property wealth district or a low property wealth district. That student should have the same access to success under Minnesota standards. So we know that adjustments need to be made for differences in students and differences in districts, and we're going to get into that in a few moments. And there are some significant district differences that exist between students and districts. And we know that resources are required to build and maintain facilities. Resources are required to meet state standards without reliance on local levies. And if you hear one resonant theme today, and you've heard it for as often as you've heard me speak, it's that levies are not the way to run basic educational programs. They have their place, they have their purpose, but not to deliver a basic educational program. And we know that local levies should be for extra programs and services. Ultimately, we hope to build a stable, sustainable, predictable revenue stream. These are the characteristics of the funding system. Frankly, if you do good work and you create a recommendation akin to this or entirely separate from this, you might measure it against these characteristics. We did not invent these. These come from the literature of school finance. These are the standards by which school finance systems are measured across the nation. Our basic funding framework has three component parts. It focuses on the learner. It focuses on the district instructional services, and it focuses on the district support services. And we'll get into some of the details of each of these as we move forward. Let's talk first about the learner. First of all, the numbers, the $1 billion, the $1.7 billion, whatever numbers you want, are research-based numbers. They were produced by individuals that look all across the nation. You can find different results looking at different individuals. There's no doubt you can have dueling data in this kind of a business. And frankly, we're willing to engage in a discussion so long as the task force, as it moves forward, suggests that the decisions that you make are research-based. That's something we would endorse. We endorse within our billion-dollar number, $1.7 billion number, that all students are counted as one, as opposed to a convoluted system that suggests that kindergarten students are weighted different from secondary students and elementary students come at a different rating than middle school students. Students are one, and within our numbers is the notion that all-day kindergarten is a part of the program. We believe all-day K needs to be in place in order to deliver today's standards. We also recognize that at-risk students require more resources. That if students are students, certainly, and they have common characteristics and traits, but there are also significant differences. We're going to get into some of those differences in a short time, including English language learner differences that require more resources. And finally, and I know you addressed special education to a great deal, or to a great measure this last session, but real current year costs for special education simply need to be covered in any comprehensive school funding formula. So we're going to say, what are we after? In special ed, this is probably more commentary than anything else, but most of the data, all of the data would suggest that the state isn't keeping up with the cost of special ed. I could make the case in my own school district that I might not need a levy referenda. I might not need to ask the voters for more money if special education were fully funded. Open enrollment is a factor in special education, and we need to address this factor because it's a tremendous cost driver. We're still uncertain what the state assumption of the responsibility for special education tuition billing is going to do for us, but I would suggest to you that school districts still come out as losers when we start to service open enrollment students. We simply have more costs associated with delivering services to them than we have our reimbursement coming back to us. And so if you're talking about reimbursement, we need to take a look at salary benefits and contract costs, as we have to contract out certain services. Supplies and equipment need to be covered, and we need to cover costs for significant program growth. I will acknowledge you made good steps forward this last time, and we would hope that as you continue forward with this, that you'll take the next steps with special ed as well. So, the learner component factors. All students are one. That's basic student weighting from K through 12. ELL students get an additional weighting. The Myers research would suggest that 0.9 is the appropriate additional weighting. Again, while we can advocate for that from our research, we're willing to engage in a discussion about other kinds of research, one way or the other, if it takes additional resource to educate an ELL student. Let's quantify that and let's fund it accordingly.
Dr. Vandell, and for members, I am going to take questions as we go along, and I have a question myself on that one. In any of the research that you looked at for other states or anything that's research-based to get to that 1.9, did any states talk about having a cap of 5 years versus not, like Minnesota does? And were there any states that looked at having a higher multiplier for students who are really beginning to learn versus those at the tail end of learning?
Should I answer yes? Would that be too much of a response?
No. That's the answer?
I'm going to suggest to you this, that I am aware that in the research, all of those variations on the theme exist and have been addressed. And I would invite the task force to bring in truly experts in this field. John Myers is one such person, and stands ready to come in and talk about his national expertise. But there are other groups as well, not affiliated necessarily with firms. The Education Commission of the State stands ready to come in and speak with you. The National Access Network, for example, stands ready to come in and speak with you. And they could provide very detailed information on this. Plus, within this state, there are experts at our major universities that could answer that as well. The short answer is yes, there are other ways to do this. Myers and Company settled on the 0.9 adjustment based on their research.
Without any cap.
Without any cap. So what we would suggest this about a cap is that we would not advocate a CS Minnesota for an unlimited non-proficiency based funding stream. We would suggest that there be proficiency measures, and as students meet those proficiency measures, that weighting comes down and might go away. So it's not a lifetime commitment to an ELL student. It's a commitment so long as there is a need that must be addressed.
Mr. Vendell, can you tell me, Madam Chair?
Senator Barna.
Thank you. Mr. Vendell, can you tell us how you have addressed the special ed student in terms of a weighting?
We have vibrant discussions about the weighting of a special education student, and in fact, great debates. And I was one of those individuals that debated with John Myers that weighting is something that's understandable, and so weighting might be something that should be applied to special education. In fact, John argued, I think very satisfactorily, that weighting does not truly account for the differences in student needs. That there are some students who have speech services and some students that are medically fragile and have incredibly high levels of service. And that unless you're willing to expand the weighting over that whole variety of students, that it really wouldn't be a good, understandable, logical, rational system. So what we've done instead is we said, let's look at the cost drivers associated with delivering the services to those students. There are fewer costs associated with the language student than with the medically fragile student, so the formula would adjust for that. Not weighting, but rather cost.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vandell, I don't understand what you're saying, because the medically fragile student, where are we in the formula that you're addressing, where are we taking those costs into account?
Let's put my special education up here. At current year, if special education funding came to us in accordance with the cost that we have with educating that child, then the differences would be accounted for. Because if the medically fragile child requires a couple of adults monitoring health and delivering educational services, and the speech and language student only needs an hour or two of assistance a week, if you code the cost of the hour or two, you code the cost of the couple of adults, you have the differential associated with if you have a cost reimbursement model coming from the state. That's what would happen.
Thank you.
Good question. Learner components put together. Count all kids as one. Make certain that you multiply that one times an adequate base. And frankly, in the Myers research in 2004-2005, that adequate base was significantly higher than it is today, close to $6,000. You then make adjustments for the students that are ELL and at risk. You add in the cost of special education, and you cover the cost of the learners, both the children that are all standard learners and the children that have special needs.
We have a question from Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Vandell, I appreciate the I appreciate the common sense in that everybody understands that a student who doesn't speak English can't learn in an English language classroom until we get them up to speed, and that not everybody's walking in the door with the same experiences, same richness of opportunity as everybody else, and that special education students have daily struggles that the average student does not. So I like that, what I'm, because it meets both common sense and experience test. What I'm not seeing up there that concerns me, however, is concentration as a factor. In Minneapolis, we've had some struggles with the Southeast Asian community who need and receive ELL services, but have issues because you'll end up in a classroom with a 30-kid classroom with 25 kids who all speak the same other language, and it's not a good environment then for them to practice their English, because the easiest thing is to talk to the little buddy next to them in whatever the language is that they speak. And there's challenges to concentrated populations of ELL students. Obviously, to have one at-risk kid in a classroom of 30 is very different than having 20 or 25 at-risk kids in a classroom of 30, if we could get the classes down to 30. So where is an acknowledgement of both the common sense and the experience of concentration being a factor in your formula?
Dr. Vandell.
Had we rehearsed this, this would have offered me the perfect segue into the next section.
Always glad to help.
It is, in fact, a significant consideration. And we talked about three different factors here. We talked about learner component. We're now going to head into the district component, where you're going to see some sense of what you just addressed, because you're absolutely right. The numbers of individuals with certain at-risk circumstances do impact learning environment, and adjustments need to be made for that. We all acknowledge that there are differences between kids, and there are common concerns between kids, and we attempted to try to address that with the learner component. We're moving into the similar kinds of concepts. There are notions of similarities between school districts, and then there are differences between school districts, and certainly we need to address those differences as well as the common concerns. The two different district component parts are district instructional services, where you'll see some of that, and then also under district support services.
We have one more question with Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Vandell, did you define at-risk student as you worked your way through this component factor?
Yes. The definition in the APA research for at-risk, the proxy is the word that would be used in the literature, was free and reduced lunch population. Are we arguing that that's the best proxy? No, we're suggesting that that's a good starting point for discussion. It is the most commonly used proxy across the nation. Okay. I'm moving into the district instructional services component and make certain I don't lose track of Representative Dabney's comment, because it doesn't really come in this next section, but it will come a little bit later. If you buy the notion that kids are kids and then there are kids, districts are districts, and then there are districts. This is the section that really says there are districts that have different needs and different... And in truth, the further we've gotten into these presentations and the more we've talked about this, we recognize we really should collapse this into learner component and district component, and then quit trying to pretend that there are two separate kinds of district components, because this really does all blend together. The most common differences associated with delivering education in the state are embodied in these next three items. There's a cost difference associated with district size. It's an economy of scale argument. I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks, when I stepped into the Stock Rapids Rice situation, that we're 333 out of 339 school districts. If you take a look at numbers 1 through 10 in terms of total state funding, they're in fact the very smallest school districts in the state. And they have large quantities of money because they have incredible economy of scale issues. They don't have choices but to run class sizes sometimes in the low teens, because that might be all of the students that they have in the district. They don't have any choice but to have very high percentage administrative costs, because they need a superintendent to run the school, they have a small student population, and if you do that economy of scale divisions, you'll see that it's a high cost of doing business district. And one could argue for consolidation, and the state as policymakers has argued consolidation for many, many years.
That was a part of my dissertation research, and there have been several waves of consolidation. And frankly, one could make the case that you've done about as much consolidation as you truly can do and still meet geographic needs of kids. There might be a couple of places, but wholesale consolidation isn't going to solve this problem. Consequently, we're suggesting that a good formula address the issues of economies of scale. It adjusts for district size. There are also costs of doing business in a particular location. It costs more money to do business in regional centers. It costs more money to do business in some of the metro centers. In some counties, it costs more to do business on the north side of the county than on the south side of the county. And the first item that I have on here, frankly, makes some of my metropolitan counterparts a little bit squirmy, because they look at some of the numbers that some of the outstate schools have and say, I could get by if I had that number. And frankly, the second item on this list makes some of our outstate people a little bit squirmy, because they say, if I had that levy referendum, I'd get by just fine. But the issue is that there are costs associated with economy of scale, and there are costs associated with location. And both of these are addressed in the PS Minnesota funding framework.
A question from Representative Heid Gerken.
Yes, thank you.
Is this being taped or anything? Should he come to the mic? Could you come to the mic?
All right. My question has to do with the cost. I'm going back again to cost associated with district size. And one of the big problems right now within my district, I have 4 schools that are in SOD. And the problem that we have, Representative Dabney also has, and that has to do with the closing of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And politics gets involved in it. I can use one example of a school district out there in Pope County that had consolidated. And they had found out in order for them to make ends meet, they closed a building in 2 different towns. Mm-hmm. When that happens, the towns get mad. One particular town, they all went to another school district. And the other town says, the heck with you, we'll start a charter school. So they started a charter school to defeat the exact purpose of what they're trying to accomplish. I've got another school that's voting on a levy referendum that the suggestion has been to close buildings. But they know they're already located in 4 different towns. The minute you do that, you got the open enrollment situation. They're going to be gone, and gone quickly. You haven't accomplished anything by closing buildings. So those are, I'm wondering, you know, that. And the other thing that has never been figured out is when we go through the consolidation. Consolidation is great, but we have never funded consolidation to its entirety, to its finality, I might say. The minute you start to consolidate, you put school districts together, you got to get rid of faculty. You get rid of faculty, you got severance factors. I've got school districts that are just getting hammered on paying severance for years to come. None of those things are addressing this issue either. And I go on. I mean, I've read the PS report and I've gone through it a couple times. And it's very, I mean, I will bring up some other ideas later, but I was not happy with the report in itself. But with that said, if you want to answer any of my comments.
Certainly. We did not address the issue of consolidation. We did talk about the factor of declining enrollment, and that's the third component part here. I would suggest, going back to my own research in this area, it's 15 years old at this stage of the game. I was doing research in the early and mid-90s. Consolidation was best accomplished with the carrot approach as opposed to the stick approach. And the state, in fact, has some carrots, some incentive programs in place. Were those fully funded all the way throughout? That wasn't the true focus of my study. All I did is made a couple of observations. If, as a public policy consideration, you would choose to move the direction of incenting school districts to consolidate, that's, in my mind, a factor associated with this, but that's not been the focus of our study. You didn't find it in here, Representative Heidegger, because it really wasn't what we were all about. Okay. The third factor is one that you have begged, however, and that is the issue of declining enrollment. And we recognize that declining enrollment is a significant factor. And I could practically give you the pitch from my levy stuff, because I get asked about open enrollment all the time. We're a 2-to-1 open enrollment district. We have 2 students coming in for every student that is leaving. And I've had people challenge us that the reason why we're asking for a referendum is to educate those other kids. And my argument is that the reason we haven't asked you for a levy referendum for 10 years is because of those other kids. Because you talk about 20 students, and 20 students seems to fit in the mind of my taxpayers, and just round the number at foundation at 5,000. 20 students brings $100,000 to the Sauk Rapids Rice School District. It doesn't cost me $100,000 to educate those kids once I've got my infrastructure costs in place. It costs me maybe a teacher, and frankly, I don't have a 1-to-1 ratio any place. So I can take the extra money and put it into the rest of the program and help subsidize the rest of the program. However, if I'm a declining enrollment district and 20 kids leave, I have $100,000 that leaves. That's typically two teachers that have to leave with that 20-student exodus. We recognize that we must adjust for declining enrollment. I'm not arguing that you adjust forever and always, you pay for phantom students forever, and I'm also not suggesting you don't have some of these component parts in the existing formula. But what I am suggesting, what PS Minnesota is advocating, is that these component parts need to be research-based and laced together with all of the other parts of the funding formula.
Justice Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, question, declining enrollment, when you look at that, did you factor in, the minute you have that in any school district, I got a school district on one side of me where I live is growing. They've got the advantage of adding teachers. The minute you add teachers, you're adding teachers that are probably step one on the pay scale. On the other side of me, I've got a district that's got declining enrollment. They're constantly cutting teachers, never adding new ones. So because of that, you've got the experience mod. One of the things that was involved in Anderson Miracle was where we paid teachers, and I think it's still a little bit part of a funding formula, where we paid teachers by experience, school districts by experience. They got a really experienced faculty, they got extra money. We want to take care of school districts with declining enrollment. What a better way of doing it. Because those school districts that decline in enrollment are going to have nothing but experienced teachers and no beginning teachers. You get hit with the insurance costs because of it. You get hit with everything. I mean, it's going to affect everything all the way down.
Professor, can you refer to what I believe in the 80s and the 90s was referred to as the training experience
formula.
Mm-hmm. And that was sunsetted some years back, and that was a policy decision from the state of Minnesota. One could argue that what you just described is a part of the cost of doing business in a particular location. It is also a cost associated with declining student enrollment. I want to try to suggest to you that a 5-page document could anticipate everything that needs to be considered in a formula. This was a starting point for discussions, and we're so pleased to be able to sit with you to raise these kinds of considerations and hope that through your discussions you can incorporate them in a rational fashion into the total package. Because they should be addressed.
And I should mention at this point, I was on a forum with Dr. Vandell and Senator Clark in September, and I made the comment that PS Minnesota gave us a bill with lots of holes in it, and Dr. Vandell said it was never his intention, at least, to fill in the holes. That's our job. And so, the more they would finish everything up, the more probably legislators would resist, because we like to do a few things ourselves. So now here we are with having to see what we can do, and the time has passed to criticize any other plan, and now we're on the hot seat ourselves.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bana.
Thank you. Representative Heidgerken brings up really good points, and I, when I'm listening to him, I'm thinking that it may be that we don't look at declining enrollment as a per-student problem. We look at it as a community issue, and we know how important it is to the vitality of a community to have schools, and so perhaps there shouldn't be some consideration of what we do for a school district in general to offset declining enrollment so that we actually incentivize a community to be able to keep their schools, because I think this problem that he raises about the charter schools then coming into compute when a school closes is a situation that none of us feel good about, because we don't want to have, what tears apart a community is when the parents are choosing one versus the other, and I don't think any of us want that to happen. So perhaps we haven't come up with the best way to address declining enrollment, and that should be a part of the discussion.
Just to suggest a couple things. I keep wanting to come back to Representative Dabney's comments. This paper addresses a little bit
better, the issue of concentration. I want to suggest to you that as we've tried to assemble the district instructional support services and the district support services component, we wish to acknowledge within the formula the challenges associated with concentration. The research, however, in concentration is not exactly what we thought we were going to find. We thought that the highest concentrations of ELL, for example, were places where the highest cost might exist. But there are some economy of scale arguments that come into play with concentrations as well. You reach a point in time where if you have significant populations of concentrations, that the weighting might in fact be able to be reduced. That comes out of some of the Myers research. So I try to move on without giving short shrift to what the representative suggested. But we're moving to district support services and talking about the key factors that need to exist. Right now, the funding system in Minnesota sets up a competition between kids and computers and curriculum, and in fact, one could argue that there is no truly adequately funded component part. So as a result, you know, I get to choose between having classroom teachers this year or having new computers or having a new curriculum, and I'm going to have to say we try to fall on the side of classroom teachers wherever we have the opportunity. The district support services component is to suggest that there are operation costs associated with doing business. Building operation costs, technology costs, transportation costs. There are, in some cases, desegregation costs, and we've been advocating that state pilot program costs that exist should be available to all of the school districts in the state of Minnesota. In transportation specifically, and I'm not a transportation expert, and we could parade before you people who are. But we suggest that there are some things that need to be done differently, and these are some of those. The state should define the level of service and fund the real cost of transportation. The levy referenda elections that are happening right now hinge in some fashion on whether transportation is going to be in play or not. And there are districts that are suggesting kids are going to have to walk or they're not going to walk based on what happens with this with the levy referendum. In our case, we're a suburban district for a couple of our schools, and one of our schools is a rural district. A one-mile walk across Rice, Minnesota is a mile-long walk, but it's not the same as a one-mile walk across Sauk Rapids, where there are railroad tracks and there are busy intersections and there's lots of highways and throughways. We're suggesting that the state needs to define what you expect for transportation services and then fund those at the real cost of delivering those services. We recognize that there need to be adjustments made for sparsity because, again, the cost of doing business is different in different places based on your own geography. Special education transportation needs to be fully funded. We are required to deliver. We need to have the funding to support that. We need to have adjustments for hazardous conditions such as they exist. These, again, are component parts of a formula that have been in place in various degrees over the course of time, but truly not fully funded. We need to have adjustments for energy price spikes. We live in a fixed budget environment, and when those costs spike on us, we end up bleeding out of the educational program. And there are fleets across the state of Minnesota that are in decline. The infrastructure of our transportation system, I'm not talking roads, you've heard about that all you want. I'm talking about the fleet itself needs to be rebuilt, and we need resources in order to make that happen.
Dr. Vandell, did you talk about rolling transportation funding out again, or didn't you?
We talked about it as being a separate component of a comprehensive formula. But it should not be a part of the education component. It should be a part of the infrastructure cost. I have put here before that I remember very well the first year that transportation was moved toward the general fund, because at the teacher bargaining table that year, the head negotiator looked at me and smiled and said, you know, I've got some concerns about the high cost of transportation in Sauk Rapids Rice. At the bargaining table, his concern was, you know, are we spending money that could otherwise go in my contract for transportation? And we smiled back and said, we're keeping these very separate, and we have tried to do so along the way. But just the fact that they reside side by side makes the temptation great. So what is it that we're advocating? A basic school district funding formula that has a learner component. Kids are kids, and you make adjustments. You multiply those student counts times an adequate base, you add special ed. You add the district components to it, and what you end up having is a formula that truly can deliver the resources necessary to meet the state standards. But there are lots of places that say standards aren't enough.
Because in our community, our value set is such that we want to do more than just meet the standards. And we would argue that school boards should have some discretionary authority to go beyond the base program. Some, that's a very fuzzy word. It's difficult for policymakers and people want to say how much. That's a policy consideration. And this educator would tell you not much. Some educators would tell you a considerable amount. We recognize that's policy and politics. We also know that voter-approved levies to go beyond the base program are not necessarily a bad idea. But the contest in my district is not for whether or not we should teach French in third grade. The contest in my district is whether we should have 25 or 35 kids in third grade section. That's what that election is about. We should not be funding base programs out of operating referendum, but we should be talking about going beyond. These should all be equalized, and they should all be limited. The research would suggest to you that the limitation of those two combined should be no more than about 15 or 20% of formula. Again, you can dispute that, you can argue that, but nonetheless, that's what the professional research would suggest. And finally, beyond the formula, there needs to be a fair funding formula to allow districts to construct new facilities. What Representative Heidegger said a little bit earlier about districts valuing their buildings and all of that kind of thing. We recognize that if there is state money associated with these kinds of programs, then the state should have some standards that districts need to meet. There are places that shouldn't be building great big buildings because they're in population decline and 10 years from now may not have the students to support that building. That community should not get the same access to state equalization dollars as the community that can show a sufficiency of plan over the course of time. So we're not just arguing for willy-nilly equalization. We're arguing for equalization that is vested in state standards along the way. So if we frame next steps, our hope was what Representative Browning suggested a little bit earlier, that you would, in fact, work toward the next step. We think there are some policy considerations that come into play. We think that one of the first things that policymakers need to do is to make a determination of what the state's mission for public education really is. And right now, we argue that your mission has been abrogated, given to local school districts in the form of operating levy referenda. You're letting school districts decide their fate based on the will of the voters. But you are setting the standards. You're requiring us to meet the standards. But you're not funding in a fashion that's sufficient. We think you could start by talking through what the mission is. Bear down a little bit and say, what should programs look like from district to district? We talk about adequacy. What is an adequate program of studies in Hopkins versus in Centennial versus in any other place in Minnesota, Eden Valley, Watkins? What program commonality, what program platform should be in place? And do you fund those adequately? Those are policy-level considerations. And frankly, we think that one of the prime policy considerations here is where would the resource come from in order to fund adequate school formulas? They should be targeted, and they need to come from someplace. We're not here trying to make the case that if we simply engage in a Sophie's choice, you can have the resource to fund the schools in accordance with our needs. We recognize that the pie needs to be increased. We recognize that this is a tax discussion. We're not elected officials. We're school officials. We're here to suggest to you that the public policy discussion needs to take place around some taxes. And within that context, really hope you discuss the role of levies. There is a place for a levy in a school funding formula. It's not where it currently exists. In terms of your next steps, we might argue that there's more data required. And we look around this room and there are people that are statisticians and theoreticians and good minds here who can engage in data searches. We know that data will be needed. We recognize that you need to engage in practical discussions about things like proxies for at-risk students, concentration factors. Those kinds of things simply need to be addressed. Those are things that we hope this committee embraces. We suggest that you need to talk about a transition from existing systems to new. And frankly, we're a little fearful about discussions about things like location cost indexes in isolation from everything else. We embrace the notion that there are cost of living differences, but we would hope that you incorporate new ideas in a comprehensive formula as opposed to take things on in a piecemeal fashion and create greater levels of disparity and inequity. We believe that your greatest challenge as a practical consideration is how to take what we think is a greater good approach and do that in a highly political environment. But we recognize that over the course of this great democracy and in this great state of Minnesota, we've been able to engage this discussion before and prevail. And it's our hope that you will do the same. And frankly, we're hopeful that you'll adopt the practical timeline. In a perfect world, we would love to have you bring a formula forward and fully fund it in 2008. And everybody around this table is smiling. Because we recognize that the world is far from perfect. We would hope that by 2009, that task can be accomplished, and that you use the session and the outlying month between now and 2009 to make that be a statement. Our charge really is to seek a rational system of school funding that is tied to the standards you put into place, and one which benefits all of the children and all of Minnesota. And that's what PS Minnesota's charge has been. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to lay this before you today. Happy to answer more questions than I have. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, and I appreciate that framework and the fact that we need a mission. Do you think it's enough that we have our standards and then we're working towards what we need to achieve them, or are you thinking of something more?
The most common question we've been asked, Representative Riley, is what should a school program look like that delivers those standards? And it has not been our charge to create that. But we recognize we need to be able to respond to that. What's the role of art and music in an elementary school in terms of delivering even math and science standards? And there are places that are beginning to abandon art and music specials because they can't afford them. Is that what the state has as a vision of a comprehensive program of studies for the students in Minnesota? I would embrace those kinds of conversations and encourage you to go that direction.
Any other questions? President Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I like your donkey very much on your
thank you very much,
very
nice. President Garofalo. I figured you would.
I
got it on the very first night I was elected one of my campaign workers in 1992, and I cherish it. If you ever find it on the floor, be sure to give it back.
I should buy one for my mom. She's a Democrat.
There you go.
So is my dad, my brother, and my sister. I'm the only one.
What happened to you?
Yeah. I joke with my mom that I'm adopted, and she says no, that when I was born, the doctor dropped me on my head.
Won't even comment.
Yes. She was there. Yeah. On your first slide, it catches my attention. It says, a Minnesota miracle unraveled, and you have a question mark. In your personal opinion, not speaking for the group, is that a statement or a question?
I would list it as a statement. I think it's a statement of the obvious. The Minnesota miracle was officially put to rest, I believe, in the early 2000s when the state suggested it was going to take over the funding formula. And as I remember that that political discussion, it conceptually sounded like a good idea, except the state was unwilling to pick up the cost of fully taking over the formula. So you abandoned what was an equalized system of funding with the blend of state and local investment.
Madam Chair, I didn't do nothing. I wasn't here, so he said I. But
what was the big deal in the general?
If a young legislator were to go up to the legislative reference library and they were to listen to the committee hearings on the discussion of the Minnesota miracle and the discussions of what percentage of education funding should come from the state of Minnesota, do you know what that percentage would be? When they were offering the bill, what they said, what percentage of all revenue should be?
My sense is that they were looking for about a 70-30 split. 70% state money, 30% local money.
And Madam Chair, to the testifier, do you know what that percentage is today?
I'm familiar with the fact that it, in aggregate, appears to be about the same, but I'd also suggest to you that that aggregate does not account for districts like my own, which do not have a levy in place at all, so consequently the numbers are skewed by very high referendum districts.
So, Madam Chair, to the testifier, if I'm not supposed to use the aggregate as a legislator, what number should I use?
What number should you use?
I'm not going to use the Madam Chair. Yeah, if I'm not going to use the aggregate, if I'm not going to use the total amount of money spent in the state, what number should I use?
I don't know that I have an answer for you on that. Because frankly, we've talked about a total number of investments, We've talked about an investment that needs to be made in an equalized fashion across the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota Miracle was inherently equalized until operating referenda became a significant portion of that miracle. And we would return to a system that would include a local equalized investment based on the property wealth of the school district.
And according to Greg Crow, who's here and does his analysis every year and did one this year after our bills were passed this year, it's 78% right now. But, you know, the Minnesota Miracle involved a lot of tax policy as well, including commercial, industrial, including cabins, including a lot of things that we now no longer have in our tax structure. So I'm thinking that this could, I long have advocated for having the tax committee and the education finance committee work closer together, but the charge of this committee is not to redo the tax system. We're not going to get to recommend, well, we could recommend it to the tax committee, but it won't be what we address in the education finance committee, whether or not we go back to adding in commercial, industrial, and so forth. I had a chance to meet at length with Representative Ann Lenteski a couple of weeks ago to talk about these very types of issues, and it was her comment that she did not believe the tax committee would be passing anything if we wanted to put education funding back on the property taxes, which would be putting back the Minnesota Miracle. So, you know, we could have a larger discussion, including the tax committee, but that's, I'm thinking the PS Minnesota did not address that, and we have, between now and January, we're probably not going to address that. But if we want to broaden the discussion and include the tax committee between when we finish our task, it's, you know, certainly something we could, we have the power to do if they're interested. Dr. Vandell.
Yes, Representative Riley. Representative Riley. Well, I want to take on swing what you suggest, because you asked me as an individual. I'm sitting here as a field member. We have not, in fact, studied that. As an individual, I would suggest that the percentage split in the Minnesota Miracle is an appropriate percentage split. And it would be my personal hope, but I believe the PS Minnesota Coalition would work toward it, that we would have a similar split when we were done. But that 30% local effort would not be less subject to the political, I'll use a hard word, whims of a school district. There will be districts a week from now that will be impacted by the cost of gasoline. There will be districts a week from now that will be impacted by things that are happening in the local economy, a factory that might close or open. And while those are significant economic factors in those communities and in those people's lives, the education mission of the school system needs to move forward. And if we're talking about a stable, sustainable funding system, that funding system needs to be predicated on something other than a changing economy at the local level.
Before we go to our next items on the agenda, are there any more questions for Dr. Vandell?
Madam Chair, I actually did have a couple questions.
Representative Rackwell, please go ahead.
To accept the fire, we've outlined some items here in a new formula that would be increased or provide more enhancements. Are there some areas of the existing formula that PS Minnesota could highlight should be reduced, or perhaps in the current state, overstate, where money should be going to? In other words, we've seen the items that are going up. Can you highlight the areas where there's recommendations that should be reduced?
Dr. Vandell.
Madam Chair, Representative, could I outline them? Not this moment in time. That has not been a subject of our study. Would we be willing to go into that formula and begin to take a look at component parts which we think should no longer exist? I have, as an individual, long been suspicious of grandfather clauses in formula. And I've made bad jokes about the fact that my grandfather passed, but some grandfather clauses simply never go away. And there may be some things that we could suggest no longer meet the test of the current standards or the modern system.
And that's my final question. In the area of levies, my friends on the school board in my area have pointed out that when our local counties want to raise taxes, they just do it. They don't go to the voters. When our cities want to raise taxes, they just do it. They don't go to the voters. And they have argued that as an equal of county and city government, perhaps they should have that authority. And I'm wondering, did that item, and in all honesty, I think it's a reasonable argument that they make, that
if someone's upset with property taxes and the county and the city take it out of their hide, and then the only vote that a citizen has is to take it out on the school, which might, maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, but it disproportionately impacts one branch of local government. Did PS Minnesota discuss that issue at all about seeking expanded authority for local levies without a referendum or perhaps adjusting current law?
Mr. Vandell.
Yes, Representative, if you take a look at page, I'm sorry I put this away before I should have. What is the page where we say beyond the formula?
Page 5.
Page 5. We talked about school board discretionary levies exist for local initiatives beyond the base program. We did talk about it. I would probably have some colleagues that would not like what I'm about to say, but I would significantly restrict discretion because discretion still is so vested in the property wealth of the school district. There are some places that could exercise discretion because it comes at no skin for the local property taxpayers. It's all commercial industrial and it doesn't feel like it hurts anybody, even though we know those costs get passed along.
Yep.
And in some places it comes with high tax impact for local property owners. And so if you're going to have it, it needs to be minimal and it needs to be equal. But we have not advocated for the same system as cities.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
So you know, Rip, I read something recently that school districts used to have that ability up until about the time I was born. So they haven't had it for a long time, and there were infractions and people were clamping down on the schools trying to protect property taxes. But why they only pick the schools is beyond me as well.
29 years ago is not that long ago.
Yeah, there you go. But anyway, I am from a property wealthy district, and we have Rosedale, and I'm an AMSD district, but I actually, and it might, maybe my lobbyist here representing my district won't like me either, but I actually agree with Dr. Vandell, and that's why I push for better state funding, because the more we expect local districts to pay, then we get into these inequities. And so, you know, I really think that our biggest charge here in this task force is to look at how can we have better state funding, and then we won't have all these kinds of arguments as why is it that my district can levy and get what we want, but Representative McFarland isn't as able to because he is an outer ring suburb and doesn't have as much property wealth as I do, not to mention Representative Heidgerken's district. So I think it's my idea that we have to really concentrate on state funding, and that's the better way to do it. And so I supported the state taking over the funding of the Ventura days, but everybody was in this room was nervous that we wouldn't actually keep up on our end of the bargain. And, of course, we didn't because Governor Ventura recommended expanding the sales tax substantially to things like haircuts and attorneys and clothing and other things. And we legislators cherry-picked his proposal, and now we have only ourselves to blame that we have all these levy referendums to make up for what we're not doing. So that's why we have this report. And so thank you very much. And do you want to say anything more about the House called it the Location Equity Index, and the PS Minnesota called it, what was it again, the location?
Location cost metric. It's semantic to a great degree. We support the concept. We support the concept of a small school size adjustment. We support the concept of differentiating at-risk students. And we recognize that a lot of work needs to go into determining how best to do that. We hope that work is research-based. What we hope is that works be brought together in one comprehensive package. The fear is that well-intentioned individual solutions might lead, temporarily at least, to greater inequities and greater challenges. And I would just encourage you to take on things like location cost metrics because they should be a part of this formula. Take them on in concert with the other things.
And that's why I wanted to bring it up now rather than single it out completely. But do the senators have any questions about it? Because I agree with Dr. Vandell on this point as well. The House did bring it forward last year. It was part of our education bill. But we brought it forward with a very small amount of money just to get it in there as a placeholder because we thought other things that are in this report are all currently in statute, and that way, by bringing that one in, it would be on an equal basis with the others for discussion, but we just barely funded it. And but I think it's a better idea to look at all these things in tandem, and so to pull it out of the agenda for a big presentation, you know, unless senators have specific questions, it's the discussion that PS Minnesota has that it costs more based on housing and salaries to do business in the metropolitan area. So to have some kind of cost differential, just like we do for sparsity and things like that. Representative,
Senator, thank you. That's fine. Doctor, do we know what the total cost of that implementation would be?
Of the location cost metric? We probably have it buried someplace within our data. We didn't do data runs, but we did have some general notions of things like that. But I can't be the person. You've got wonderful people around this room. The data runs that we did came out of the John Myers second report. He worked with APA at that time. And he gave us just some raw data that we didn't get a chance to filter. It was before we'd written the formula. And so what we did is we said, we really can't start doing any district runs until we start truly refining formulas. The quip that John Myers typically uses when he does a presentation like this is that the problem with data runs is that people engage in downright disease, is that you take a look at what your district is. We can't, as a coalition, get caught up in that ourselves, so we're just going to say we're not going there. The folks around this room could do that once you begin to construct the
form. Madam Chair, it was me who requested those few things, and just as a context for why they were on the agenda, I felt it was important as a body that we hear about all the different funding ideas that have been on the table and have been discussed, working towards a more equal way of funding schools. And so I concur with Representative Greiling that that bringing one piece out in isolation doesn't make sense, but wanted to make sure that we understood what had been discussed last session so that in the context of all the different possible ways we could look at reforming the funding formula, it was addressed.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Spogin.
Madam Chair, do you intend not to bring it up separately then?
Senator Spogin, my intention is to work with this group and come to consensus so that we have a total package, our version of PS Minnesota. We'll have to think of a good name for it, I guess, because we couldn't possibly take that name because we're legislators. But some kind of education finance reform and adequacy recommendation to our colleagues were slated to be done by January 15th. But I think as we discussed here today, because next year isn't the funding year and it doesn't look too rosy for what we're going to have available, I think we're really talking about making a recommendation for the 2009 school year. So whether anything is enacted in this coming year or whether we discuss it again during the session and then look toward enacting it in 2009, I think remains in question. How, you know, can we come to agreement or are we still in flux ourselves? You know, I'm hoping we get at least some kind of draft, just like PS Minnesota did, on paper as a draft, and then, you know, some of us, if all of us would be nice, if we could agree that much, author it and then send it through the process. And obviously part of it will be a big price tag and we won't have the money next year. So then we'll have to decide, can we agree on it enough to have it go forward with a little part of it funded or not? And maybe it's the sort of thing that if you don't do a bigger piece of it, it wouldn't be equitable. But like I said, we put the location equity index bill forward last year just so it could be discussed. It's in this report. And all the other things exist in current law except for that piece. It's been around at the legislature as long as I've been here. And it never meets with any kind of welcoming ears because people see it as, what more money for the metro area? You know, surely they don't need any more money with their tax base and this and that. But so I have to confess that I was very happy when TS Minnesota, using research methods as they did for all the other components currently in our statute, decided that this would meet the test of a real cost differential, not just a wishful thing to get more money for the metro area. I was hoping when they did their research that it actually would also benefit regional areas like Rochester and Duluth and St. Cloud and, you know, name a regional center, and I wished it would count for that. But somehow or other, if you're going to really do it with ethically or mathematically, you can't, because you can't, there's no way you can legitimately come out with the same cost differentials for any other area of the state, for housing and for teachers' salaries. And actually, Parents United was telling me the other day that the teacher salaries aren't even the bigger thing. It's more the bus driver salaries and the cook salaries and the people like that that, you know, you can have for a lot less of a cost in a rural area compared to Minneapolis. You know, think of what they have to pay with union wages for bus drivers and cooks. So it really is a true equity issue, and that's why we named it the Location Equity Index, because it is an equity cost differential, and so we really want it to be discussed. We highlighted it. I would have loved to have had it passed just as a placeholder, but I think we put, was it $3 million or something into it, and our estimates of it based on our staff last year, I think it was, if it was fully funded, it was something like $200 million. And, you know, we don't expect to get $200 million for that if we aren't doing all these other pieces. So
I guess that was my question, is how much time we're going to spend on that, what the real dollar of that is, because I'm not from a metro area, and I'm concerned about that type of money going into the metro schools. Just so you know, and then
fair enough.
I guess have somebody testify on what it does to for the achievement gap, or is there that kind of $200 million? Would it be better spent on all day kindergarten, fully funding it, or special ed costs that we're not a bill that we're not paying? But if that's not the discussion today, I mean, we're going to have other meetings. I just want some direction from you, Madam Chair. Is that our discussion today, or do we save that for another day?
It could be our discussion today while we've got Dr. Vandell here, and it could be our discussion, you know, anytime as we're going along with these discussions. We've already talked about having more discussion on English language learners, because there were some questions that Representative Dabney was asking, and Dr. Vandell suggested that we have John Myers here. You know, I think for any of the cost differentials, we would be best off sticking with research, and I'm hoping we get into, you know, what's legitimate and makes sense in the very context that you said about student learning. I know that that we could get bogged down otherwise if we don't figure it out based on what is needed by all districts to be on an even playing field so that every kid has an equal opportunity around the state. So I would like to put it in that context, and if we can't come up with this group with the political will for funding all the formulas to the extent that we should, then I don't think we should fund any of the formulas to the max. We should figure out what ratio do we want for all the different cost differentials, and then figure out some way to move forward on all of them at the same pace after we've argued on, you know, what should be the ratio. And I would hope that we would mostly focus on the formula, because if we would have, I'm talking about the per pupil formula, that if we would have a higher number for that, then the cost differentials would, you know, we'd have less funding that we need from levy referendums. You know, I don't know. Maybe we need to have more cost differentials and less on the formula. But that's part of what our charge is. But I don't have any desire to focus on the location equity index unless it's in a total package, because I don't see it going anywhere unless we're in a total package. And that's what I think TS Minnesota has too. Total package. Representative Erickson and then Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Vandell, can you provide us with a bibliography of the research that John Myers used in sharing with you the finished work?
I will ask Mr. Myers to produce for us a bibliography, but a bibliography would suggest you run into research that is published. In fact, what he did is he went into data fields, but will at least be able to demonstrate for you what the data field you find.
Thank you.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just to comment on Senator Scogin's comments on the location equity issue. It's something that Representative Benson had this last year, and I know I fought it off the year before when Representative Sharon had it, and Representative Sycor, I think, had the year before that. But it's been around for quite a while, and I think Representative Dabney has been there, and we've had the battles, and I've always said that if you're going to be a teacher in Icahn School for many years, 23 years, if I had a choice where I wanted to teach, I most certainly would perhaps go to the richest area in the cities and say, I want to teach there because guess what? I'm not going to have some of the trials and tribulations that you have in the small schools or that you're going to have in Minneapolis. I think if anybody deserves to be a PA, probably more than anybody would be one from a district that has some really dire needs. And the students have dire needs. They're challenged all the time. When I first started teaching school in Ashby, I was told I'm teaching 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade. I had 5 preps. That was never brought up in location equity. That was never brought up in any of the discussions when you're teaching out of state. You don't have one prep. When I student taught over Litchfield, I could have had 5 sections of U.S. history, one prep. Senator Scogin, you'll never get that in any of your rural school districts. Your teachers are required to basically teach that many more different courses, more preps, more work, more of a workload. The other thing that is never brought up is when you retire. Your retirement out of state is going to be considerably less because your retirement on your retirement pay is based on your high 5 years. Out in rural Minnesota, you're always going to be getting $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 less for doing the same job. The other issue is when you sell a house. The average home in some of these richer areas of the cities probably sell for $250,000. After 30 years of teaching, you probably got that paid. You got a nice little nest egg. If you taught school out there in Minnewaska, the average home in Firewall is $30,000. So all this time you can use that as a write-off on your taxes and everything else. Houses is a good write-off. It's why people redo their credit cards and put it on their houses because you write it off. So again, those things were never brought up. Representative Danny, you brought up, how about the regional centers? Just about 75% of the teachers at BBE will drive to a regional center to teach. Over half the teachers at Morris and Olmier living in St. Cloud. They're all driving back and forth because they got everything there. You don't have to drive to the grocery store. They want to see a play. They want to see a movie. Everything's there. You got little Minnesota, you got to drive for everything.
Well, I'm going to cut you out now because we have 2 more items, yes. And we're going to end at 5 o'clock. No matter what. And the cost differentials are all over the years, for various reasons, controversial by themselves. If you take any cost differential, you will always have, what did you call that, the down and right syndrome. Everybody will look at, let me see, do I like this cost differential? How does it benefit my district? So I think it benefits all cost differentials, if we look at them as a package, and this is certainly one of them, and to make sure that we are focusing it on the research based on how does it affect children's learning, and you hit the right question. And I think we have to have bigger minds than mine to answer all these questions, and that's why I think the idea of having some of the research people come in and talk about these things from a national standpoint is a really good idea. But we didn't allow enough time for it today. We do want to allow time, though, for the consolidated levy that the Senate had, because part of our charge, as I said at the beginning, is the simplification. And this one at least simplifies some of the levy, so it meets that criteria, just like the location equity does for cost differentials between districts and between students for student learning. So, Dr. Vandell, if you're welcome to stay there and comment on the consolidated levy from the viewpoint of TS Minnesota, but we also may have some Senate staff who want to present that. I'm not sure what you had in mind.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nauman will be presenting it, and I have to say that Mr. Nauman is going above and beyond to be here today to do this because he just got back from Europe. He has jet lag, and and he's doing a great service for the committee to be here with us today.
Dr. Vandell.
I can't tell you how pleased I am that Eric Nauman is here because I had no idea I was going to be asked about consolidated levy. I just have to make something up. The fact that I got some views on it, but yes, Minnesota is really not approached from policy considerations. I get 30 seconds here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to come and present to you today. And you raised wonderful questions, and the same kinds of questions have been raised within our own coalition. We represent small schools and large schools and property wealthy districts and property poor districts. And we've come to a point where we've recognized that there is a better way. And go back to that sign that just posted outside the high school. There is a better way. The way that we've presented may not be perfect, but it is a better way than what's currently being done. And we know that if you take us to the next step, you can, in fact, recreate America. We would stand ready to help you with that all along the way. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for the inspiration. And we're expecting everyone in this room to be helping us every step of the way. And Mr. Nauman, before you start, I have to tell you that Shannon Patrick said that she, our committee administrator in the House, said she ran into you in Germany. And shortly before that, I was with a woman who teaches religious philosophies at the University of Minnesota. And I was meeting with her on something, and along came somebody else who fit in with what we were doing, and she said if you run into somebody unexpectedly, then that is a blessing from on high. And so when Shannon Patrick came back and said she ran into you in Germany, I said, don't tell me Eric Nauman is a blessing from on high. Were you excited? You must be.
No, sir, I'm not really sure what to say to that. One thing I can say is that I feel like I must be twice blessed because I ran into your committee administrator, and then the following day I ran into Representative Leader, who was at the same museum. He was traveling down the Elbe River with a group as well. He didn't recognize me, but of course he's the House member that his counterpart, Senator Stump, so I recognized him. Madam Chair, with my jet lag is a nice excuse. I'm going to go down memory lane a little bit. And I think it's my understanding that what you're looking for is just sort of what did the Senate do with the consolidated levy? Why did it do it? And I think I'd like to reserve most of the time that we have left that you want to allocate to this discussion for questions. And I'll just quickly go through the document that looks like this. There's a chart on one side and a table on the other, and I'd like to start with the table. But first, some opening thoughts. I think the Senate Education Finance Committee saw the consolidated levy as a response to some of the growth in property taxes and as a way to, as Senator Stump has often talked about it, stabilize the property tax levies in the system. It did that recognizing that there already are levies in the system, and the way to stabilize them is to absorb the monetary value of those levies and impose that similar in a manner that was similar to the old general education general education levy that was, as has been previously discussed, eliminated or bought out in the 2001 reform. So how did the Senate proposal work? Well, if you look at this table, you see under current law, we have actually four levies in the general education system, and I'm going to leave one of them out for the purposes of this conversation because it was really unaffected by the proposal. The equity levy, the operating capital levy, and the transition levies to collectively, in fiscal year 2009, based on the February forecast, we're going to have a total value of $219.2 million. The Senate had a little bit of one-time money, and I'll get into that discussion in a moment, but you can see that those levies would expand 234.7 and 248.6 in fiscal years 10 and 11. What the Senate proposal did was take the value of those levies in fiscal year 2009 and mechanically reduce them by $100 million and then impose a levy at an equal rate across all districts, and the resulting amount was 119.2. If you make the division, in other words, divide out, and that levy would be imposed on the adjusted net tax capacity of all school districts. If you divide that total value, the 119, by the adjusted net tax capacity that we were using at the time, it was about a 0.018% tax levy. Now, because we only had the target to buy those levies down by the $100 million in the 1 year, you can see that on the last line, the rate pops back up to 3.2, and then about 2.0. The Senate committee, I think it was fair to characterize, felt that moving forward beyond 2011 is when the real benefits to this occurred, because property values were continuing to grow on the projections at the time. Once you move beyond 2011, the total value of the levy that was imposed remains at the $248.6 million. So as property values grow into the future, as we had at the time, the total value would remain locked in at $248. Unlike what's happening in the current system being one where we take the total value of the levy and make a division based on an equalizing factor, that tends to reward the state budget by creating savings as the property values grow, because to the formulas, school districts look richer. And what that does is create savings on the aid side of the budget. So the Senate committee felt that the benefits were more in the longer term than in the shorter term. If you flip the chart over to the other side, and I'm happy to deal with questions if you want to talk about that, but I want to speed along to get you as much information as you can in a short amount of time. This chart shows where we were in 2003, the first year of the buyout. And this is just the general education levy, so we're not talking about referendums or health and safety or anything like that. So we were at zero in 3 and 4. In 5, levies were added back into the general education system, and 6, and then there was another increase, policy increase, to those levies in 7 and 8. Then the Senate proposal, and now we're looking at fiscal year 2009, shows where the drops down to the $119 million. You see what the projection would have been at 238, and then that line continues. That top line with the diamonds represents what the forecast was showing. And then we show the Senate proposal as that second line with the squares. And we've made some assumptions so that you can see that it flattens out in 12 and 13. Those are those beginnings of the out years that I was talking about earlier, whereas on the projections, those continue to grow. And that essentially represents the Senate proposal. I can talk in greater detail if you want. I know that there are some data runs that may be controversial to the extent that you think about this issue moving forward. But Madam Chair, I want to be respectful of your time, so I think I'll pause there.
Thank you. Mr. Nauman, next we have the presentation that came from the department on the operating capital, and that was something the House, we had that in our bill as well. Does that at all conflict with what's being proposed here?
Well, Madam Chair, I wouldn't say it conflicts. I think it's a different knife to cut your apple. I think both efforts are attempts to create reduced property taxes. The Senate's proposal was a reduction of property taxes, but it was also a stabilization at an equal rate across all districts. There was also a data run, I think, in your package that shows that under current law, if you make a division of the existing levies by ANTC, which I know is a crude approximation of how one would accurately show the burden, but if you did it that way, you'd see a whole selection of a bouncing around of what the rates are across districts. This was an attempt to end up with an even tax burden across all school districts. And you would still have that bouncing around under the operating capital initiative, which was simply a let's change the equalizing factor and create more, put more aid into the system and less property tax levy.
But you could do both.
Madam Chair, I actually would say that if you do a consolidated levy, and unless you didn't consolidate operating capital and left that in the system, which you could do, there would be no need to do the operating capital initiative if you adopted the Senate's recommended approach from last year, because you've consolidated the operating capital, and maybe I didn't speak to this directly enough, you then eliminate those levies. They're gone. And what you have is that one single consolidated levy left.
And then my last question, and then Senator Bonas, the transition revenue, I'm hearkening back to Dr. Vandell's comment on things that are grandfathered in. His grandfather is dead, and you notice everything is... Transition revenue is to transition, but doesn't this kind of make it permanent? I mean, shouldn't it be until the transition is complete and then it fades out?
Madam Chair, I'll disagree with Dr. Vandell only to a minor point. Generally, these grandfather initiatives do tend to stick around for a long time. However, we used to have an old transition that we eliminated as part of the 2001 reform. So we have done some effort at getting rid of them. In 2003, we recreated a new grandfather and called it the same name. So that's where it does get a little confusing. And that was slated to phase out after, I think it was about 5 years. And for whatever reason, the legislature in its wisdom eliminated the phase out. So that did not occur. What I would read this to be is it leaves the transition revenue line in place. It wouldn't change the revenue that any of those districts get. It would eliminate that levy portion, and then of course the levy gets replaced on the backside with the transition correction with the consolidated levy. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, my head is still a little fuzzy. I haven't talked about this in a couple months.
Senator Bonas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nauman, am I correct in understanding that when we do our consolidated levy, that after this is all consolidated, it gets funneled through the aid levy split formula that is applied based on property wealth, and that a distinction between that and what we're going to hear from Mr. Melcher is that that consolidation is total aid, so it's not subject to a property wealth factor.
I'm not sure I tracked with all that, and the last thing I'd want to do is to try to anticipate what Dr. Melcher is going to say. But I think the way what you might be thinking about is that with the consolidated levy, you make you calculate the revenue for all school districts as if there was no levy in the system at all. So it's just a straight aid calculation, or in this case, a revenue calculation. So you know how much revenue school districts are going to get. And then you make a calculation based on how much levy is in the system or the legislature wants to be in the system, and you mechanically create a rate and back that aid out. So what you're left with is what we have in the count in the 119.2 million. But we could make that number 120 million, or we could make it 115. Have I answered your question?
A follow on, Madam Chair. So am I still correct in understanding, though, that the amount of money that ultimately goes to the district that comes from levy versus aid varies depending on where they currently sit with the aid levy split?
Maybe I'll put words in your mouth and says it varies based on their property wealth.
Yes.
And that would be the answer would be yes.
Okay,
with that, let's have Dr. Melcher come up. Maybe, Mr. Nauman, if you could stay close by, because some of these are intersecting questions, it seems to me. And we could hear from Dr. Melcher and then conclude with questions for both of you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I do have a single sheet handout that's in your packet. It's actually two-sided, and I also have a data run that I won't go through the details unless you have questions on that. But the single sheet handout is labeled operating capital revenue. I've given you a brief history of where we've been with operating capital revenue. Historically, there were equalized tax levies to fund operating capital. It was a categorical outside of the general fund. In 1997, operating capital revenue was rolled into the general education program and became all state aid at that time. It remained all state aid through fiscal year 2004. And then as part of the state budget balancing in the 2003 legislative session, there was a levy introduced with a $22,222 equalizing factor, which was a relatively high equalizing factor, creating a high state share, but nonetheless introducing the concept of levy for the first time since the late 90s. And then in 2005, there was another move to lower the equalizing factor from $22,222 to $10,700, which resulted in a further reduction in the state share of funding for this program. In the 2007 session, the governor recommended a partial restoration of the state aid for the program, increasing the equalizing factor to $17,590, and the House File 6, which was considered in the House, would have increased the equalizing factor further to $33,000. What you see in the chart on the bottom of the page, page one here, is the history of the state share, so that we were at 100% state funding. As a result of a change to the $22,000 equalizing factor, we dropped to about a 79% state share. As a result of growing tax base in school districts, there was a slight reduction in fiscal 06 to 77%. Then as a result of the further reduction in the equalizing factor by the 2005 legislature, the state share went down to 47%, and then it's continued to decline since then because of the growth in tax base with the constant equalizing factor. So we're currently at a 38% state share on the average overall. If you turn over to the back side of the chart, we have a little scatter plot at the top of the page which shows the tax rate as a percentage of adjusted net tax capacity in each school district compared with the adjusted net tax capacity per pupil unit. The large group of districts in the upper left-hand corner indicates that most districts are levying a tax rate between about 1.7% and 2% of adjusted net tax capacity, which turns out to be about $4 on a $200,000 home, and in round terms. The tail that goes down toward the lower right-hand corner is the effect of the higher tax base in those school districts that have a tax base higher than the equalizing factor of $10,700. Those districts are able to raise the approximately $200 per pupil with a little lower tax rate than other districts. So we are creating some differentials in terms of the tax rate required to raise the approximately $200 per pupil in operating capital revenue. The chart in the middle of the page, the top set of numbers here, or the top set of little dots, is current law. The governor's proposal is in the middle. The governor's proposal would have reduced the tax rate for most districts to about 1.1% of tax capacity, and that would have cost about $44 million to lower that tax rate for the typical district from about 1.8% down to about 1.1%. In the House proposal, with the $33,000 equalizing factor, it would have gone the same direction but further down to this lower block here, where the typical district would have been levying about 0.6% on tax capacity. So both the House and the governor were moving in the same direction. The governor recommended about $44 million. The House bill had about $80 million in it to reduce the tax rate. And I think the concept involved here was to try to provide fairly uniform reductions in the tax rate so that school districts across the state would all see some property tax relief coming out of the 2007 session. And the little chart at the bottom was kind of a summary of how the bills would have impacted different regions of the state. So we have Minneapolis and St. Paul, other metro, which would be the suburbs, and then we have rural districts outside of the seven-county metro area sorted based on the size of their enrollment. And what you can see over on the right-hand side on the current column, the third column from the right, is that we have a pretty uniform tax rate across the state. We have a few outliers, but generally the school districts are levying about 1.8% of tax capacity. Under the governor's proposal, we would have had a pretty uniform reduction, about 0.6% reduction to bring the tax rate closer to about 1.1 or 1.2%. And then under the House bill, we would have had, again, pretty uniform reductions across the state, reducing the tax rate by about 1.2% to get us down to that 0.6. So the concept here was to provide a fairly uniform amount of property tax relief to school districts across the entire state.
Thank you very much. And to be clear, this is property tax relief, not money for schools. But we had, in the House bill, we had $125 million property tax relief, all of which we lost at the lower target, which was $80 million. So any questions from any of the members for either Dr. Meltzer or Mr. Nauman? Senator Bonnet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping somebody else would ask it, but Mr. Nauman, do you have any sense of, can we compare apples to apples if we look at the consolidated levy, how that relates to this chart in terms of what the actual rate of net tax capacity would be?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonnet, again, I think we're kind of going back over the same conversation we had before. We could do some analysis to make a comparison, but I think in general terms, these are two separate approaches. I think as Dr. Meltzer just indicated, the primary benefit of taking an approach by adjusting the equalizing factor the way both the governor's recommendation last year and the House position last year did, is that you give fairly uniform reductions in property tax levies. You still have a divergence, not a great one, but you have a divergence in rate. And that was a policy effort that the Senate bill contained in the consolidation to try to end up with even rates. And we had to spend some money, $100 million, to get most districts on the negative side of the property tax side of the ledger. I know that's not directly where you're going, but if you have some desire to make some comparisons on those in more detail, we could certainly undertake that effort.
Thank you.
So the goal of your consolidated levy, like the operating capital proposal, was to lower property taxes as opposed to get more money for schools?
Madam Chair, I think that you yourself made a separation between more money for schools and the property tax side of the ledger. So I think to answer that question, I would make the same separation and say that on the property tax side of the ledger, the Senate committee had two desires. One was obviously to reduce property taxes for most districts, but was also to create some fairness in the system where the committee felt that we were getting less fairness. In other words, we were getting more divergence in property tax rates, and we wanted to bring them back to a uniform tax effort. And to embark in that kind of an effort, we had to consolidate them and then impose the levies in a different manner, more akin to what we had done with the general education levy.
So more equitable relief, but still the goal is obviously property tax relief rather than education funding.
Sure, and Madam Chair, I don't want to step on your toes, Tom, but I think that if Senator Stumpf were here, he'd say he would have loved to have had a larger target for the purposes of reducing those levies and would have done so if he had one.
Yep. We're all in accord on that one.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add, and I don't disagree with Mr. Nauman at all, but just another way of characterizing this was that the governor's bill and the House bill were aimed at providing uniform tax relief across all school districts. The Senate bill, in my view, was providing more targeted tax relief aimed at the districts that currently have relatively high tax rates to try to bring more districts down to more of a uniform tax rate, but that meant some districts would get more tax relief than others in order to get to more of a uniform tax rate.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Bonnet and then Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Nauman and Dr. Meltzer, I know the Senate also talked about
The consolidated levy is having the effect of stabilizing school funding. It sounds like that that with that as part of the goal, that perhaps with Dr. Melcher's approach, that that didn't do much to stabilize the funding stream. But would you say that's true?
I'm not sure I'd ask Mr. Melcher to comment on the word stabilize. I think that that has been a word that has entered some of the conversation in, within the legislature, but not a lot of conversation about what that has meant. I think when that was first talked about in the Senate, the meaning behind stabilize was the Senate was recognizing that there was a levy component in general education, but that that levy component was growing based on the current way those levies are structured. In other words, they're tied more directly to growth in property taxes. And so the Senate's approach was allow that growth to occur over the 3 years of the projection and then lock it in after 2011. And I think that that's what was intended behind the word stabilize, that after 2011, it remained at that roughly $250 million into the future unless the legislature took a proactive policy decision to make that number higher or conceivably lower.
Richard Harrison, you get the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dahman, would you just very briefly clarify the last two columns of the printout? I think I understand it, but so Senate file 2095, that was the reduction, and then is the last column what the levy would have been for each district then, the total dollar amount?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I think you're looking at the rate run. It shows numbers of 1.81
yes,
all the way down.
Yes,
I'll quickly go through. The first group of columns in the box display current law levies in general education without the QCOMP program. And then we make a division of a rate. And it's a real proxy. It's not perfect because we've got referendum market value levies in here as well.
Okay.
But then the next step is let's consolidate the levies, and you end up with that 3.34 rate. So a district that was above 3.34 in its rate in the prior column would have seen levy savings. A district that was the other direction would have had a levy cost as they moved more to that mean or that average. In the final column, you'll notice there's that 119.3, not the final column, the second to the last column, 119.245 million.
Yes.
That's the number that tied to the chart. That's after the $100 million of buyout.
Yes.
And then we make the same division, and that's where you get that 1.81 rate.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you both very much. The next meeting is most likely going to be on November 15th, 1 to 4. Our Senator Bonoff's office and mine are trying to find dates, and we had scheduled the 15th and the 28th, but it turns out that Representative Morrow can't make either one of those, so we're going to have to make some adjustments at least to the date of the 28th so we can get him here, and I don't know if we've polled the senators who aren't here to see when they can be here, but we're trying to find times that work best for everybody. Everyone doesn't live 10 minutes from the Capitol like I do, so I can come almost any time, but we're trying to arrange around other schedules. So if you have input, let your respective staff know, for your senator or representative. Thank you very much. We'll see you probably on the 15th.